If you think you can't go from politics to the divine, Carol Gold and Steve Clark are about to take you above the fray. The only agenda here is to empower you to think for yourself, ask more questions, and trust your own truth. So now, the combination talk radio has been missing. Until now, Carol Gold and Steve Clark taking you above the fray.
Hi, I'm Carol Gold. I'm at here. That's not even English. I'm here above the fray, where the number is 914-803-4522. I'm here with my co-host, Steve Clark. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Carol.
Steve, I think that one of the most important things one of the most important things coming out of what's happened in Charleston in that tragedy, and even that I had some thoughts on right before I went on the air that I'll share shortly, but I think that one of the important things that's coming out of that is a reevaluation, or at least an awakening to how division doesn't help us. I don't think we all have to think alike or be alike, but there are certain things that definitely do perpetuate seeing ourselves as separate. And I would argue, and I don't know your thoughts on this, I would argue that one of those things is sort of the cultural hangover from the Civil War, that there still is this mentality in the North that the South is strange. I know. I had it till I moved to Texas. I grew up in the Northeast, and I figured everybody below the Mason-Dixon line was, somewhat Neanderthal. And what happens is that in my case, when I moved here, nothing could have been further from the truth. I love the people of Texas. I love the people of the South, at least the people that I've encountered. And I love the culture in many ways, at least where I'm living outside of Austin. And in the South, the whole mentality of Southerners who have perpetuated some of the hangovers from the Civil War, best exemplified by the Confederate flag, and that's obviously where I'm going with this, Steve, is I think it's a symbol that has stood for division and a refusal to move past a certain time or mentality in history. I don't necessarily mean that anybody who flies a Confederate flag is a racist or hates black people, but I do think the flag is a constant reminder, and therefore should be in a museum, of a time in history when this country was divided against itself. And having just lived through 6 years of the most divisive president we've ever had, particularly as it relates to race relations, how ironic, he's black, that I think it's a good thing that the South, and South Carolina in particular, which spearheaded secession, that South Carolina is reevaluating the flag. So that's where I'm coming from, and I'm interested to hear you, Steve.
Carol, I think it's a little bit, I have a different take. I like you, grew up in the Northeast, so by no means do I think that I'm a Southerner. But at the same time, I've lived in Florida before. I spent time in the Marine Corps. I lived in North Carolina for a number of years before I moved down to Texas. And I can tell you, being in the Marine Corps, I had a lot of Southerners in my unit, and they wore a flag proudly. And by no means am I a historian, but I do know the context of how the South likes their flag. It's hard to explain to a Northerner until, as you probably know, Carol, until you live here, the sense of pride that they have in the South, the sense of nationalism that they have, especially here in Texas. But even in the South, there's an element of us versus them. And part of it, the Northeast looks at the Southern flag as, I would say, somewhat as kind of antiquated, somewhat as of a kind of a racist symbol, but the Southerners don't look at it. And if you look at the flag has 13 stars from the original states, and part of the origins of the Civil War were economic in nature. It's always been a battle. from the North and the South, and the South was much more believed in states' rights. I remember my father, when he was younger, having friends. He grew up in Oklahoma, and spent a good part of his youth in the South, having friends that were named states. And part of it was the people used to name their kids in the South like states' rights. And there's a prevailing notion of freedom in the South that I think gets passed on generationally. I'd say less so now, and now we kind of have the remnants of it. But that's really where the origin of the flag is generated from, is this kind of oppression that they felt from an overwhelming overreach by the government, the federal government, that caused the war. And so, yes, the Civil War was part due to slavery, but it was also a huge part was economic in nature, that the Southern states didn't believe that they should have to send their taxes up to the North. And so I think that's the context, and that's the backdrop that I looked at the flag at. And I realize that a lot of people don't look at the flag in the same way. A Northeast liberal that I'm very, you know, Northeast liberals that I'm familiar with and I grew up with, they look at that as something as racist in nature. And I would say most Southerners would be appalled by that analysis, because that's not how they view it. I can't speak for the Black community in the South, or do I want to, or the North, and how they view it. But I can only tell you how the Marines in my unit and the people that I know and the people that I spent time with, Black and white from the South, never looked at the flag in that context or didn't see that in the context. That's my experience. So I just think it's I think, unfortunately, you know, Obama has injected race into this matter again and trying to defuse it. But the narrative gets picked up by the president who sends out and makes his comments, and the media follows suit with it. It becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy or self-fulfilling news cycle, and they start talking about how these things always happen in the South. And I'm not one to believe that these things always happen in the South. I tend to believe, or having lived in the South and the North, that the culture is much more hospitable, much more educated, much more civil than I've found anything to be in the North, the Northeast. Having lived near housing projects, having lived near some, you know, pretty tough urban areas in New York City, in Jersey City, and this is going back from the 70s in New York City, and Jersey City in the 90s and 2000s, which there's many parts of Jersey City that are not very nice at all. So I think I have a kind of a good understanding of the dynamic, and so I just think that. Those are my thoughts on it, Carol. What do you think?
Well, as I said, I have a little bit of a different take than you do, but I want to inject a completely different perspective, and that is, you know, I've always said, and I think I actually might have even said it contemporaneous with or even before Martin Luther King said it, which is that you can't legislate morality. So what's happened now, the result of what happened in Charleston, is that in the political world, you're seeing this movement to get rid of the flag. The bigger story out of Charleston is not the political story. It's the human interest story. It's the fact that this church didn't riot and the neighborhoods didn't riot, that instead they came together and prayed and offered forgiveness both for the murderer as well as for his family. And to me, this is how we change the world. We change it with our hearts. There's no law you can ever pass. There's no edict you can ever issue. There's no flag you can ever ban that's going to change a person's heart. The only thing that changes heart is an understanding of our relationship to our Creator and our relationship to one another. And so I think that temporarily what's getting the big play is the flag issue, because it's easy to write about, it's front and center, the governor can order that it be taken down from state public state buildings or public buildings. I'm not sure yet what she's ordered by executive order, and that will be the story for a while. The real story is that love is what makes the difference. That true Christian, true Judeo Christian values is what changes the world. So I looked, you know, before we went on air, Steve, I had this really strange thought that these people, these nine people, were like lambs. They offered themselves up because it's their death and the loving way in which the community is coming together in true spiritual grace that is making a difference. And so the same way that Jesus's life was offered up, so to speak, I don't believe he was the Messiah, but I get spiritually, I get energetically that his life was offered in a sense, not as, I don't believe it for our sins, but it was a way to wake people up at the time so that they understood the cruelty and the hatred they were capable of and the love that they just let slip through their fingers by allowing him to be killed. The same way that these people invited this guy into their prayer circle for an hour, this stranger, and they loved him and they embraced him, he turns around and kills them. And what does their death mean? Well, their death means something rather amazing. This is in comparison to Ferguson and Baltimore, it's the difference between what evil does and what love does. Because in Ferguson and Baltimore, we saw the victory of the dark side. Not only was there death, but then the reaction to the death was more destruction. Whereas in Charleston, we have death, and the reaction to the death is harmony and unity and love and oneness. And if there isn't a more clear picture on the planet of what it is that is our way out of our division with one another. So taking down a flag is purely superficial and symbolic. And quite honestly, you raised the point earlier today with me that I thought was very important, Steve, and I'll share it in a minute. But first, let's go to a caller. Area code 504, did you want to join the conversation?
Yes, my name is Roger. I'm calling from New Orleans, and I was just perusing through what shows might be of some interest, and I come across the topic that appears to be addressing the news of the day.
Yeah. Okay, so Roger, I don't know how much of the show you heard, but we're talking about Charleston and the really loving reaction of the community, which is really meaningful. In versus just taking down a flag, which is symbolic, and I was making the point, Roger, that the way the community is reacting in Charleston is light years away from the way the communities acted in Ferguson and Baltimore, and we see the difference of what love can do as opposed to what anger and destruction does. So, Roger, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think that the commonality of the reaction to the police killings in the situation in Charleston is that you have racist attitudes against blacks that are reflected by people of different walks of life. So, I mean, the issue here, the elephant in the room, really that's not being talked about, is the white backlash against a black president. And the young man who committed these murders, his rhetoric was encased in the politics of today. And the things that have been said even more intensely over the last 7 years.
Roger, I want to ask you a question. Are you an African-American?
Yes, I am.
Roger, let me ask you this question. If I don't like President Obama's policies, if I don't like his economic policies or I don't like his foreign policy, and if I have reasons why I don't like his policies, am I a racist because I don't like his policies?
No, you're not a racist because you don't like his policies. However, what we have seen over the now, and I'm not a conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican. I don't subscribe to those particular ideologies solely. But I think what we have to admit, now, I'm 46 years old. I'm a post-civil rights child. I was born after all of the excitement, quote-unquote, of the civil rights movement. But I can tell you, I haven't seen racial issues as bad as I've seen in the last 7 years, particularly in the last 2 years. The anti-Obama sentiment has become part of an overt expression of animus and venomous towards black. In other words, you can't get to President Obama, but you can get, not you personally, but I'm saying the angry whites can't get to President Obama, but they can get to the blacks that are near them. And I tell you, it's been bad. It's been bad. And there's a lot of rhetoric that has come with being opposed to his policies that is connected with expressions of racial hatred.
So the way I see it, Roger, is that from the black perspective, and you have to tell me if I'm right or wrong because I'm white, I can't is right here. From the black perspective, the nation is divided and the anger is out front and center because there's white backlash to a black president. From the white perspective, it seems to me, for many people, the issue is we had our first black president, and he did a lot to divide the country instead of seizing the moment and bringing it together. And so it looks like if you're black, you see it one way, you know, no pun intended, black and white. If you're black, you see it one way, and if you're white, you see it another way. I'm not saying there aren't whites who are racist. I'm Jewish, Roger. There are anti-Semites of every color. Yes, there are people who are racists. But I think there's a lot of bad calls of blaming people as being racist who simply disagree with this president's politics, not his color.
Right. What I'm saying is you have to be honest. What has come with the hate for the president are racist expressions. Now, this president has been the most disrespected president sitting in the White House. People yelling out, calling him a lie, these things. And I mean, I can't even list all of the racist comments that have been said openly underground on the radio by people who have been angry because of this. And so we look at this young man who committed this massacre. He was probably only 14 years old when the president was elected. But yet we see that his language he uses for justifying what he did is rooted not only in an age-old racist perspective, but also buttressed with the current politics of today as it relates to race.
Steve, did you want to get in this conversation?
No, I don't have much to add here. I just, you know, when I look at some of the stories, I could see how it gets, like you said, how it gets phrased black and white. But, you know, I only look at, you know, my basis of comparison would be, you know, let's say the last two presidents. I mean, George Bush was viciously attacked for his last few years of his presidency, and obviously it's a white majority, so nobody claimed racism, but he was savage. In the same way, you can argue that Bill Clinton in his last few years of his presidency, his wounds were much more self-inflicted, but he was savaged as well. I mean, these guys both were put through the ringer, and we never had those conversations of a black white thing. And I think part of what's happening to President Obama is just the same thing that happens to any president. There is a viciousness that comes from holding that office for so long. And so,
well, Steve,
I don't have the eyesight, and I can't see it from where I sit, and that's part of it because I'm not black, so I don't see it that way. But I can see how somebody who's. I'm sorry.
Let me ask you this, Steve. The equivalation of the president with a monkey and eight that has been done by members of Congress in emails, and we can go on and on ad infinitum. Now, for example, I disagree with a lot of the president's policies, okay? But there comes a point where, like, a person who is Jewish may disagree with a person of a political perspective who may be Jewish, but there comes a point when they realize that that person is being attacked solely because they're Jewish, and then you have to then begin to look at it from the standpoint, are we being attacked because we're Jewish? Okay. So, I mean, to not be honest that since we've had this president that there has been so much racial animus in it, you know, that is also part of the problem that's a block to try to do what we say heal.
You know, Roger, when I remember they made a movie actually for George Bush, and they assassinated him in the movie. They assassinated the president in the movie, and the movie was a big deal. It was in Democratic circles. So, here's what I think happens. You know, like kids in a schoolyard, kids can be really cruel, right? And they'll find your weakest spot and, you know, they'll pick on whatever it is. If you're a girl and your hair is curly and straight hair is in, they'll make fun of your curly hair. And if you're a boy and you're not muscular and it's a sports school, they'll make fun of you because you're a sissy or a weakling. People, when they want to pick at something, they pick at the thing that is the weakest link, the thing that is maybe will do the greatest wound. And so I remember in Bush's administration, it was such fun made of how stupid he was and how he couldn't say anything right and how he got words wrong all the time. And his entire presidency, he was made fun of as being an idiot, an intellectual idiot. And we forget maybe because those days are gone now and we've had 6 years of a different kind of attack at a different kind of president. And I'm not saying, again, that we still don't have a black-white race relation issue to some extent in this country. But I also think that it was the obvious way to pick at this president was because he was a different color.
But that would be racist. Well, then that would be racist, correct?
I'm not saying that it, is it racist? You know,
if somebody picked with a president because they were Jewish, would it not be considered anti-Semitic?
You know, yes. Wait a minute. Wait, I can answer that. I know what, because I was just putting myself in that position. If you disagree with me, and if I'm the president and I'm Jewish, and I am Jewish, so let's make believe I'm president, and you disagree with my policies, right? And you say, you know, oh, that stupid Jewish president and that stupid foreign policy that she has, you're really annoyed at my foreign policy. But you're phrasing it in terms of my Judaism because it's an easy context to pick at. However, if you're not annoyed with my foreign policy, if you actually like my foreign policy and you like my economic policies, but you walk around saying, you know, we got that damn Jew president, then you're the racist. If regardless of what you think of me, you hate me because I'm a Jew, even if I'm doing things you like, even if I'm helping you, You hate me just because I'm a Jew. But if you don't like something about me in particular and you phrase it in terms of my Judaism, I don't think you're anti-Semitic necessarily. I just think you're somewhat ignorant in how you're making your argument, but you've probably got a legitimate argument that you differ with me on my fiscal policy or my economic policy. So what I'm saying is, I think there are people in America who hate Jews because they're Jews. And no matter what they would do, they would hate them as a Jew. Just as there are people in America who will hate a black person no matter what they do. And if they discover how to defy gravity, they'll still hate that person and because of that, the person's color. But if you really disagree with the president and you're dumb enough to frame your argument in terms of his color, well, you're stupid. But you're not a racist. You're just stupid. You don't know how to make a better argument. And I think everybody's getting thrown into the same pot, Roger. Everybody's called a racist, whether or not it's about his color. Is that possible? Is there anything about that that could ring true to you?
I don't think the ADL would agree with you on your dismissing someone as being anti-Semitic if they tie a critique of a policy along with them being Jewish. I think they'll be called unequivocally anti-Semitic.
I may not agree with everything the ADL says, and that's one of the great things I think about being an individual is we all get to, like, I'm not like you, Roger. I'm not a conservative. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I am, on every issue, I am what I think. I'm driving toward the truth, whatever that is. And I assume in every issue that I can learn something from the other side. I never close anybody out. And so maybe the ADL wouldn't agree with me. I just think it's too easy to throw everybody into the racism pot when I don't think there are as many racists as there are loudmouth people who are racist. And I don't think covering other kinds of news between black and whites is as sexy as covering the murders and the hate speech. So the media gives it more play. I'm sure every day there are people out there of every color helping one another and trying to make this a better world. But what's thrown in our face every day is the worst of us instead of the best of us. And then we all walk around thinking we're the worst of us. It's like the gay population. I read recently the gay population is 2 to 8% of the population, with 8 being the highest percentage. That being the gay community's estimate of 8%. But if you stop the average person on the street and take a survey, they'll tell you the 25% of the population is gay. Why? Because it's front and center in the news all the time. And so we think it's something other than it really is. Are racists despicable? Absolutely. Are anti-Semites despicable? Absolutely. But I don't think we're as bad as the picture that's painted every day, because it helps people in power to stay in power if they can keep you and me picking at each other.
Well,
Roger, we have less than a minute and a half left in the show. I certainly thank you for calling in, and I hope you call in again. I hope you listen to the show again, Roger. Steve and I are very grateful for your contribution to the show tonight, and from my heart, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so we hope that the discussion tonight, both between Steve and myself and Roger, our guest, who phoned in and listened to the show, was enlightening, hopefully inspiring, and maybe got you thinking in a new direction. Thank you for joining us here at Above the Fray. Spread the word. We hope to always have conversations that are stimulating, thought-provoking, and elevate the discourse. I'm Carol Gold.
I'm Steve Clark.
And we've been listening to Above the Fray. Steve and I will be back again on Thursday night, 6 p.m. Central, and I'll be on tomorrow evening at 6:30 p.m. Doing my own show, Spiritual Readings, and News from a Higher Perspective. Have a great week, everybody. Good night.
You've been listening to Above the Fray with Carol Gold and Steve Clark. from politics to the divine. Thanks for being a part of a new way to see the world. Visit our website at AboveTheFrayPodcast.com and like us on our Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/AboveTheFrayPodcast. This has been Carol Gold and Steve Clark, taking you always above the fray.